from the 6th to the 20th of October.
No prizes, no stunts, no gimmicks.
Just 2 weeks when we ask you to dig deep and support Real Radio. Stories, ideas and music.
Go to 2SER.com and click on donate to show your support.
A defence which has been on the rise and has cost Australians up to
most people sort of fantasise about flying. Most people think about it. So rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? I've only done like
1%. And bang, within like a split second, I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is because there's a demand.
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge. My name is Ellie Madrich and you're on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's best community radio station. For the next half an hour, we will be bringing you current affair stories from all over New South Wales, everything from the headline stories to important grassroots information that affects you. This week, we speak to the team responsible for a huge breakthrough in the science of pregnancy. A research team out of Newcastle believe that they have discovered the cause of the majority of stillbirths in pregnancies. We also look into how a New South Wales company is converting landfill into renewable energy, and we hear from Breakfast's Nick Healy about the controversial developments in Cooks River. All that coming up on Razor's Edge, 2SER, home for New South Wales news. Now to our first story. Every day in Australia, 6 pregnancies are terminated due to stillbirth. This translates to almost 1 in every 100 pregnancies, resulting in the death of a baby. But Professor Roger Smith from the University of Newcastle and his team based at the Hunter Medical Research Institute are responsible for a breakthrough into the mysterious case of stillbirth. They have found that many stillbirths are caused by the premature deterioration of placentas. If this discovery wasn't enough, they have already begun research into creating a test for this condition. Jesse Begley spoke to Professor Roger Smith from the University of Newcastle.
Professor Smith, can you please tell us about the breakthrough you and the team at the Hunter Medical Research Institute have had in understanding the mysteries of stillbirth?
Well, stillbirth is a major problem. It's reasonably common, unfortunately, about 1 in every 150 pregnancies end in stillbirth. And often the baby, although it dies, looks perfectly normal. And it's been a puzzle as to why the babies die. And our work has shown that in many cases it's related to aging of the placenta, the organ that the baby relies upon for oxygen, glucose and all the other nutrients during pregnancy.
And so the placenta is the most common reason for stillbirth? Is that what we believe?
Yeah, that's very likely to be the case. And the reason that we identified that as the cause is we were aware that the likelihood of a stillbirth occurring increases as you go along in pregnancy, particularly in the last weeks. And this notion of an increased risk of death with time actually fits the mathematical definition of aging, which is that the likelihood of death increases with time. And because of that link, we looked at the biochemistry of the placenta in the final weeks of pregnancy and showed that many of the changes associated with aging occur in those last weeks of pregnancy in the placenta, and that we can see much more aging in the placentas at, say, 41 weeks than we can at, say, 37, 38 weeks. And then we compared those aging-related biochemical changes in placentas from patients who'd had a stillbirth and shown exactly the same changes.
Do some women make placentas that are naturally older than others? How does this work?
Yeah, so firstly, just to correct one idea there, is that the woman doesn't produce the placenta. The placenta comes from the same tissue that comes to form the baby. So if you like, the man and the woman have an equal contribution to creating the placenta. It looks as though the placenta, like you and I, are like age differently. Each person ages slightly differently from others. So I'm sure you've noticed friends who are the same age as you, and some of them look older and some of them look younger. And it's likely to be the same with the placenta. And why a particular person ages more slowly or faster is likely to be a mixture of the genetics that make up that person and also their environment. Same's likely to occur for the placenta. So they're likely to be some genetic variations, but also things like cigarette smoking might make the placenta age more rapidly.
Professor Smith, how do you plan to test for placentas that are ageing rapidly?
Well, the placenta releases some of its material into the mother's bloodstream. So we know what chemicals to look for in the mother's blood, and that's what we're starting to do at the moment. But we haven't developed this test yet. It's not ready to roll out and use on pregnant women at the moment, I'm afraid. It's likely to take 3 to 5 years for us to develop such a test. So it's still not yet available, unfortunately.
Professor Smith, what was more groundbreaking for your team, finding the cause for many stillbirths or taking the initial steps to creating the test?
For us, each part of the pathway is exciting. Just understanding that it's aging of the placenta may help many families deal with the stillbirth they've experienced, because often a lady who's had a stillbirth will blame herself and feel terrible guilt as though it's something she's done, whereas our data show that that's not what happens. Unfortunately, it's aging of the placenta, something that almost certainly she had no control over. So that may be helpful in itself for many families at the moment. Then understanding the process of aging and how aging actually occurs in the placenta may allow us to design techniques to slow aging. We're working on that. And then perhaps most importantly, to develop diagnostic tests to predict the woman who's at high risk of having a stillbirth, and allowing the obstetricians to intervene and deliver the baby before it dies. Each of these things is pretty exciting and important, I think, in helping to improve the care of pregnant women in Australia and around the planet.
So if this test can be successfully developed, what are the steps that will take place if a test comes up positive?
Okay. So if a test came up positive, we'd expect the obstetrician to carefully look at that pregnancy with other techniques, perhaps with ultrasound, and then the obstetrician and the family would have to make a decision about whether it's in the interests of the baby for the baby to be delivered before death occurs. And that will vary with each pregnancy. If the baby is still very young, say under 25 weeks, then delivering the baby may not be a very good option. And there, it might be that a medication that slows aging might give the baby the best options. But on the other hand, if the baby's, say, at 38 weeks already, then clearly delivering the baby before it dies would be the sensible thing to do.
As a scientist who has worked at the heart of this issue, do you have any advice for parents, and especially women who have had a stillborn child?
Not to blame themselves is the key thing. And hopefully work like this and even stories like your own may help to make it easier for such people, knowing that they're not alone, that there's a lot of families who unfortunately have to deal with this trauma. And it may also help for other people to be aware of stillbirth so that they can be supportive to couples and families who have experienced this trauma.
Thank you to Professor Roger Smith from the University of Newcastle and his team at the Hunter Medical Research Institute. Now, general waste is becoming a bigger problem for Australia as more and more tonnes of waste are going towards landfill and not being recycled. Companies like Veolia want to change that. With a new facility opening in Tarago, Veolia hopes to tackle down landfill waste and turn it into renewable energy that will hopefully power up to 30,000 homes. Reporter Monica Samayoa spoke with Veolia General Manager Danny Conlon on how this new facility converts potential landfill into renewable energy.
Since it's been revealed that Australia is one of the largest contributors to food waste in the world and waste in general, many people at home and companies have started to make an effort to reduce food waste. One company in particular has been working hard for over 40 years in reducing waste and turning it into renewable energy. Last week, Veolia unveiled a new mechanical biological treatment facility in Taregu, which is 240 kilometers southwest of Sydney, and will receive approximately 144,000 tons of household waste from a number of Sydney councils in hopes that it will change the way red lid bins are processed and divert away from landfill waste. We spoke with General Manager Danny Conlon from Veolia to explain in a bit more detail about MBT and what the future plans are. Can you explain to us how the mechanical biological treatment facility works?
The system's largely, as it says, mechanical and biological. It's a series of drums. We take the material, which is household waste, residual household waste from your, I guess what you call your red-lidded bin. Essentially what we're trying to do is remove the organic fraction from that waste. The waste spends a period of time in the drums, turning and tumbling the waste, and that process essentially sort of floats, if you like, the contaminants on and removes them from the process, so the plastics and any tin cans and anything sort of that's not what we want ultimately in a compost that's biodegradable, removes that from the process, and we end up with a rich sort of organic matter that we sit on maturation pads, and through a combination of forcing air through the organic matter and some screening after it's been left for a couple of weeks, we end up with a compost that we're going to use predominantly for the rehabilitation of the old mine site.
And does it only have to be organic waste, or are you also converting plastic as well?
Pretty much half of what we take into this process will be sufficient quality for a compost material. The other half is what we'd call a residual. Some of that we can recover for recycling if it's a reasonable enough quality, understanding the process it's been through. A majority of that will then go to the Woodlawn Bioreactor for disposal. But we are looking at some stage about putting a further processing plant on the back end of this to create what we call a fuel for energy recovery at some stage.
Who are your clients that are getting this compost? Is that being used more by farmers, or is there any other clients that are using it?
Predominantly the use for the compost out of this process down at Woodlawn will be used for rehabilitating the mine site. So there's a huge task to undertake between Veolia and a company called Heron, who now have the rights to re-mine at the old Woodlawn mine site. But the volumes of material required for the rehabilitation of this site is predominantly what we're going to use the material for.
So what will be the impact MBT will have for communities and for the future?
There's a greater expectation now from communities generally that we work harder to reuse those things that we have historically just disposed of. And so I think, you know, the benefit of the MBT here at Woodlawn is knowing that, you know, over half of everything that people have disposed of as general waste, thinking it won't have any further use, will be converted into compost. And from a community perspective, that's great. In terms of understanding that that's been diverted from landfill and reused, from a local community perspective, I think certainly the big advantage is understanding that there's a facility co-located now at the Woodlawn mine site that's working predominantly to generate product to rehabilitate that mine site.
And what are some of the challenges MTB are currently facing or might be facing in the future?
Challenges for the MBT is largely to make sure that the customers, the front-end customers, the Northern Sydney Councils and the Southern Sydney Councils continue to invest in, you know, the education of their residents and their ratepayers to ensure that what goes in those red-littered bins and ultimately ends up at the MBT gives us the best chance of producing more compost and less residual waste to go to landfill. That's the major challenge. Also, you know, as we sort of refine the process and look to recover more from that residual waste stream, you know, fluctuations and volatility in commodity markets and, you know, ongoing cost of running and maintaining the facility, they're probably the real key challenges I would have thought for the MBT into the future.
And hypothetically speaking, how many more facilities would need to open in order to turn New South Wales into a renewable energy state?
Well, it's just maybe if I could take the definition, how many more of these MBTs would need to be constructed and commissioned to handle all of Sydney's residual waste? Sydney now just putrescible waste, so that's waste that's got food waste in it. You know, I think it's Sydney at the moment's probably generating over 2 million tonnes a year, and our MBT is going to handle about 145,000 tonnes of that. So if that gives you an understanding of, I guess, the scale and the volume of material out there, and I guess what this facility, which is, you know, one of the largest of its kind in the world, and we're treating 150,000 tonnes of that, two odd million tonnes of waste. So quite a number, I would have thought.
Thank you for Danny Conlon for speaking with us. Now, if you haven't already heard, the latest round of voting is over for 2SER's Seeking Sydney, and the winning question is, does Sydney have an underground BDSM culture? We at Razor's Edge have already begun investigating that question for you, Sydney, and we will have an answer for you within the next couple of weeks. Now, the next round of voting will begin soon, so get online, 2SER listeners, and give us some questions and vote on what stories you want to hear. Like, has anybody ever actually been eaten by a shark in Sydney? Is Sydney Australia's next Silicon Valley? Does any opera ever play at the Opera House? Get online and start seeking. And now for our third story. You may have heard of the controversial property developments in the works at Cooks River. 52 hectares of public land, including areas of protected wetlands, are in the talks to be developed. The project, conceived by developer John Boyd, hopes to transform the old Cogra golf course and adjacent Crown land into an upmarket residential and sporting complex, described by supporters as a new mini Darling Harbour. 2SER Breakfast's Nick Healy spoke with Associate Professor of Journalism at UTS Tom Morden about the numerous barriers confronting this multi-million dollar project.
Now, Central News has obtained some documents, interestingly enough, from state government bodies suggesting that there's pushback on an institutional level, not just residents and environmental groups, over the Cooks Cove development.
That's absolutely right, Nick. These are so-called referral responses from a number of state government departments. And what happens is basically that when a council receives a development application, they're obliged then to contact any state government departments who may have an interest in or jurisdiction over that particular development or may be affected by it in some way, and to get responses from those departments. Now, the interesting thing is that these documents are actually public documents. The public is entitled to be able to see them, but council had received them, had not published the documents on its website, and we were told by a source that we should try to obtain these documents, so we did, and because they are public documents, council was obliged to hand them over to us, and we found some really, really fascinating things in these documents and indications that a number of state government departments had pretty fundamental objections to this development.
What are some of these objections?
Well, look, they range from objections from Roads and Maritime Services through to objections from the Office of Environment and Heritage. And I should add that this whole project, which has been underway or has been pushed by the developer John Boyd Properties and Cogra Golf Course now in various forms for over 10 years, also coming into the mix in recent years has been the whole WestConnex project, which is very close indeed to the site of the proposed development.
It would be, yeah.
The M5 East Tunnel, new M5 Tunnel, but we'll get to that perhaps in a moment. Anyway, Roads and Maritime Services is one of the government departments which sent a referral response. And it also, as a landowner, and this is another crucial point, the land that this proposed development would happen on is, of course, all public land.
Mm.
Yeah? It's Crown land, and the landowners are a range of government departments and Bayside Council, the affected council. And Roads and Maritime Services wrote back in its referral or its response to the referral from Bayside Council that it considered that in its present form, the current development is prohibited. This is the Chief Operating or Acting Chief Operating Officer of Roads and Maritime Services, Stephen Head. Roads and Maritime Services is, of course, the former RTA. And he said that in its current form, the development contravenes the Sydney Regional Environmental Plan 33, there's a lot of acronyms in this story, and that RMS can't consent to it proceeding. And interestingly enough, RMS also questions whether or not there's a public benefit to this development, because it says that the golf course, the proposed new golf course, which would be built on this public land, would be accessible only to members who pay a fee and therefore would be of private interest and not in the public interest.
That seems fairly damning from RMS.
Yeah, I mean, at present anyway, because, once again, this is complicated, yeah, because of changes to the planning laws, the final consent authority for this development, should it go ahead, would be the Central Sydney Planning Panel. But before it can go to the planning panel, all of the affected landowners have to give their consent, because basically what would happen is that this land, 52 hectares of land currently available for public use, parks, sports grounds, cycle tracks, and a protected wetland, all this land would have to be transferred to Bayside Council, which would then effectively lease it back to the Kogarah Golf Course. And in order for it to go to the panel, all those landowners have to give their consent. So at the moment, Roads and Maritime Services has basically said, we will not be giving our consent to this development in its present form.
Now, Central News also saw some documents, including minutes of a meeting that suggested there was a fairly close working relationship between Kogarah Council and the developer?
Between Kogarah Golf Course.
Sorry, yeah. Kogarah Golf Course.
Golf the Course, the apologies. Developer and the former Rockdale Council.
That's
now,
right.
just to further confuse you and confuse listeners, I mean, this is a very complicated story, but it's in the nature of these stories. But because they're so complex, that very often the public has a lot of difficulty getting a handle on them. And the real juicy bits of the story are often hidden away in what appear to be very boring documents. And our job as investigative journalists, and this is a project that I worked on with a group of 12 students from my investigative journalism class, we spent basically 2 or 3 months working on this project. And some other documents, as you said, that we were given access to, documents obtained in this case under GIPA, or what was previously known as FOI, by the Save Barton Park group. That's a residents group which has been opposing the development. What these documents show, for example, is that there was a meeting in 2015 between the Kogarah Golf Club, the developer, representatives of WestConnex, and representatives of Bayside Council. What was then Botany Council. This is prior to the council amalgamation. And at that meeting, for example, the former state member, John Flowers, the state member for Rockdale, said that this was a mini Darling Harbour, a potential mini Darling Harbour, and that they should definitely go ahead with it. The general manager of Rockdale Council, Meredith Wallace, who is now the general manager of Bayside Council, she confirmed in that meeting Rockdale Council's complete support for the Cook's Cove project. And also at that meeting, as I said, were some representatives of WestConnex. And WestConnex had, at the time, a very pressing interest in this matter, because they were about to start drilling the new M5 tunnel, part of the whole WestConnex project. But in drilling that tunnel, they were going to have 800,000 cubic metres of dirt, spoil, to get rid of. And Kogarah Golf Club and the developer had come up with an ingenious sweetener, if you like, for this whole deal. They said, well, look, rather than you ship this dirt out to landfill somewhere out on the edges of Sydney, why don't we use it to cover up this 52 hectares of public land and resurface it in order to create this wonderful new golf course?
Oh, wow.
And because this was going to look difficult, Roads and Maritime Services, in fact, at the time, raised some possible objections. Mr. Boyd said, well, look, I think what we need here is a whole-of-government solution. He had a word to Alan Jones, who then wrote to the then-Premier, Mike Baird, who wrote back to him saying that because of various complicated bureaucratic issues, the issue could not be approved directly by his government, but that he'd asked Urban Growth, which is that's the state-owned corporation that is responsible for major urban infrastructure and transformation projects. He'd asked them to work expeditiously with Rockdale Council, Kogarah Golf Club and WestConnex to achieve optimum future use of this site. So you can see that there's also some very high-level political and business connections involved.
Big thanks to Nick Healy and the Breakfast team for that story. And if you're interested, you can listen to the rest of it at 2scr.com/breakfast. You're listening to 2SER 107.3.
Amazing talent.
Live radio broadcasts.
Fantastic events.
You're on 2SER.
2SER is a grassroots, independent, not-for-profit community radio station. We've always stood for social equality and justice and played the most diverse range of kick-ass music. But producing great radio doesn't come cheap. That's why we're asking you to dig in your pocket to show 2SER your support from the 6th to the 20th of October. You can even do it now. Just go to 2SER.com and click on Donate to keep the stories, ideas and music flowing.
Follow your fingers, kick your heels up.
You're on 2SER.
I'm Ellie Madrich, and a big thanks to our supporters at Razor's Edge, producers Jesse Begley and Monica Samayoa, for getting these intriguing stories. Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge, 2SER's home for New South Wales news, and we will be back next week at 7:30 p.m. Thursday evening with stories big and small. We tweet and podcast all of our stories during and after the show, so follow Razor's Edge on Twitter and check all of our past stories and all of the amazing content made here at 2SER. And don't go anywhere, because Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music for you. And to take us out, we have a song from our feature album, Forced Witness, by Alex Cameron. This is Candy May.
I'm dying, yeah, 'cause I'm frail and I'm tired, and I constantly complain about the pain I'm in. But Candy May, she knows me better, yeah, she knows my weight. She has seen me naked, she knows I'm packing heat. She has a way of saying, baby, come to me complete. She's my sweet, sweet candy mate. Got me stuck and I want to stay. But I never wanted to look sharp. Down the barrel of a broken heart. So I live with a deep regret of all I do on the internet. And I'm filled with a dirty white guilt. She's a brine and a doily frills. She loves me still. They see a shadow in their vision, then it fades and then it dies. Sweetest eyes. But Candy May, don't think I'm lying. I got a flavor in my mouth that never truly goes.